New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or a beautiful printed copy of issue number 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring cultivating peak experiences with my guest, Eric Leskowitz, who goes by Rick. He served as a consultant psychiatrist for over 25 years with the pain management program at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston, where he also founded the Integrative Medicine Task Force. He holds an appointment as a research affiliate with the Osher Institute for Integrative Medicine Research at Harvard Medical School. He has written over 50 articles being published in leading scientific journals. He is author of The Mystery of Life Energy, Biofield Healing, Phantom Limbs, Group Energetics, and Gaia Consciousness, The Joy of Socks, Weird Science and the Power of Intention, Sports, Spirituality, and Science Come Together at the Ole Ball Game, which was also made into a documentary film. And he is editor of Sports, Energy, and Consciousness, Awakening Human Potential Through Sport, Complementary and Alternative Medicine and Rehabilitation, and Transpersonal Hypnotherapy, Gateway to Body, Mind, and Spirit. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. This is Rick's second interview with New Thinking Aloud. He is joining us from Buckland, Massachusetts. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Rick. It's a joy to be back with you on New Thinking Aloud today.
Thank you for having me once again. Appreciate it.
In our first conversation, we talked about how energy medicine can help with healing and pain relief. And today we're going to go a little further into your book, The Mystery of Life Energy, and explore how people can actually cultivate peak experiences. And just to get us started, what are some of the ways that you found that people can do that?
It turns out there are a lot of ways to, all roads lead to Rome. There are many different ways of getting, attaining peak experiences. The interesting thing is that, there's many interesting things, but one is that most folks tend to assume that these things happen kind of randomly and you just enjoy it when it happens. And in the meanwhile, the athletes will train and the musicians will practice and what have you. But if it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, well, maybe next time. But there's a whole new body of research and thinking that shows that there are practices, techniques, frames of mind that can facilitate this and that can enable these things to happen. And that's what some of the really exciting new work is about. I ended up focusing a lot on sports, not because I'm a particularly gifted athlete. In fact, I am not. But I'm a gifted fan, I guess you could say, and have followed sports over the years and watched how these kind of exalted states have come about. And so that's been my forum. I think I should say, just to sort of honor the lineage, that this whole study of being in the zone, peak performance, the flow state, etc., really owes a debt of gratitude to a man named Michael Murphy, who is probably best known for being the co-founder of the Esalen Institute, a West Coast center for the human potential movement from at least 50 years ago. So not only was he interested in cultivating these higher states, but he was also an avid athlete. So he combined years of study of yoga, and he had been to India and studied with Aurobindo, but also he was a high-level golfer and cross-country runner, things like that. So he noticed similarities, and he wrote about them in a book called The Zone, transcendent experience in sports. And what he did was, some of it was his theory and his conceptual stuff, but the juice of it was interviewing pretty well-known athletes who described their own peak experiences during sports. And it's quite amazing because they're talking about higher powers, higher sensory perception, athletes who, when they're in the zone, they know what the opponent's going to do. They see images of future events. They sense energy fields. They feel energy fields. They see auras. It's quite remarkable, especially because he because of his connections, he had access to top-tier athletes. So it's not just some, you know, little league player or something like that. These are, you know, well-known football, baseball, pro athletes in America. It's mainly geared towards America, but so he has a vast collection of these experiences, and he does a really good job of comparing it to some of the abilities that develop in advanced yoga practitioners called the Siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I. And he came up with a phrase that really kind of helps to combine the two realms by saying, sport is the yoga of the West. Mm. It seems like a, you know, ridiculous comparison, because as we all know, yoga is a spiritual practice, and sport is, you know, you just play it to have fun or to beat the bad guys or whatever. And what he's saying is that sport can be a path to spiritual awakening. And that's such an important, you know, new point of view that it's really taken a long time to really sink in, I think, to the culture. And so the idea is that you can pursue any athletic endeavor as a form of spiritual practice. And for example, now we hear a lot about mindfulness, and it's actually getting to be fairly common for athletes to talk about their meditation practice and mindfulness. And it makes a lot of sense. If you're in the moment, just focusing on what's happening right now, your mind isn't full of, well, what about if he throws me a curveball and the coach said I should do this? And, you know, all those common mental distractions that take you away from full mind-body focus. So meditation has really gained a very strong foothold. Part of a sign of its acceptance is that athletes will talk about it now. They're not trying to hide it because it'll look like they're wackos or some, you know, California hippie type of thing, that it really helps performance. The bottom line is that they do better when they do these practices. So that's how I got into it. And not surprisingly, there's a very strong energetic component to it, that when athletes are in the zone, you know, you asked about specific techniques. So I'll talk about one that involves acupuncture meridians, working with the emotional energy that's bound up in meridians. There's ways to access peak performance states. It's a technique that we talked about last time because it's very useful for physical healing and pain relief, but it's the tapping, the emotional freedom techniques, EFT, tapping, that athletes are using now to release some of the anxiety states. There are some sort of notorious ones that called the yips, for example, in baseball, where you just, for something gets stuck in your head and you can't complete the throw to first base, or you always swing and miss, or what have you. And there are athletes who are using this now. And one coach I really like to highlight is a fellow from Oregon named Greg Warburton, who has integrated this tapping technique into his sports psychology work with different teams. And he worked for many years with the Oregon State University baseball team and elevated them to the point where they were perennial champions or favorites to win the championship, even though they're not known, they weren't known as a big sports team like, you know, Michigan or UCLA or what have you, but they competed with the best because his work was so effective. They won three NCAA championships and used this modality. But the interesting thing was, he didn't talk about, it's almost like he didn't have a green light to talk about it in sort of public media until very recently. And part of that was because it would look strange. And part of it was, it would give a competitive advantage to other teams. So it was an interesting kind of bind. But that's one technique that once you learn how to do it, you can do it yourself too. And there's actually a pretty well-known clip, video clip of one of the College World Series games where they're showing the pitcher on the dugout waiting to go back into action. And he's going like this. and the announcers don't know what he's doing. And they're trying to, you know, make sense out of this kind of odd looking thing. And they said, well, whatever works, you know, is their way of doing it. But it's, you know, it was on national TV. And there's more and more of these examples, like during the Olympics or whatever, of athletes tapping on themselves to just get more present and get their energies aligned, because I think that's the key. Being in a flow state gets you into a peak performance state.
You also talked with a baseball player yourself, and he shared about what that EFT tapping did for him.
Acupuncture and Reiki are two popular therapies based on these energies. Dr. Leskowitz uses a related technique called energy psychology in his work at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, a teaching hospital of Harvard Medical School. And a few savvy players are using energy techniques to dissolve negative emotions and enhance their performance.
Jorge Reyes trying to relax himself. I don't know if that's acupuncture, acupressure, or just a nervous freshman trying to calm himself and stay focused. Some of the hardest part of the College World Series is waiting to play, waiting to pitch. Remember, these are the last two teams to take the field here. That freshman had to wait around and see a lot of baseball before he got to take the mound, and right now he's trying to be calmed down by the guys. Well, whatever works.
Do you mind demonstrating the
tapping? Yeah, you know, it's yeah, it's you know, you just kind of tap on different spots. You tap the forehead, side of the eye, the lips, collarbone, and just kind of there's a bunch of different, you know, techniques to do. It's just kind of it can be anything from 5-10 minutes worth of tapping and talking about it, or you know, you can go for an hour. You know, when you're home, you're getting positive energy from the fans, and on the road, it's kind of a negative energy. You know, and the anxiety gets to you, just getting the negative thoughts out and, you know, kind of erasing them and putting the positive feedback in there. So I think that's kind of the thing. You know, we worked together, and I felt nothing. I still kind of felt weird. As far as the negative side of it, but I went out there and had an awesome game, you know, and it was just like, it just clicked. I had no clue how it happened, but, you know, that's energy and the center is working.
In the air to center field, sending Desmond Jennings back, deep to center, back and gone! Two-run home run for Jared Saltamacchia, his first home run of the season.
It was surprising. This was part of a project that, well, just a little bit of background is, the word fan is a shortened version of the word fanatic. So people who are sports fans are fanatic. And I will confess to some of that growing up in Boston. It sort of came with the territory. And for better or worse, our baseball team, the Boston Red Sox, never won a championship. It was like an 86-year drought until 2004. Everything came together and they did remarkably well and won the World Series. And it had a very dramatic effect on the whole region. I was doing clinical work at the time, and one thing I noticed was that it functioned as an antidepressant for it sounds funny, but people were definitely in a better mood, you know, the day after the game that they won and things like that. It had an impact. But I was really struck by the athletes' performance and their sense of connection to each other when somebody had an outstanding game. How did they get into the zone? What was the role of team chemistry? And what was the role of fan energy? So, you know, I had done a little bit. I wrote an op-ed for the newspaper about these subtle factors. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. But my cousin, a filmmaker, actually had a brilliant idea of doing a film about it. And the way he approached it was not to tell me about it. He approached the Red Sox first. And he got their permission to show up and start filming it for my part. And then he told me, he said, what are you doing on Saturday? And I said, I don't know. So that he said, we're filming our documentary. And I said, what documentary? So it turned out to be a really fun project because the Red Sox gave us access to the stadium, to the players, to fans. And it led to some of these interactions that you're talking about. So I got to talk to some of the players about some of these unusual experiences. And it wasn't that odd. What the video that you're alluding to is on the we ended up making a documentary that was broadcast on PBS about 10 or 12 years ago. And one of the clips is I'm in the dugout, which is, you know, sacred territory if you're a baseball fan, sitting next to the catcher of the Red Sox, Jared Saltalamacchia, and he's demonstrating how he taps on his, and I didn't know this was going to happen. We hadn't been aware that any of the players did this, but, you know, the word gets out. And so he was very willing to share it and gave a couple of examples of how it really helped him, you know, settle into it. It wasn't something that everybody on the team did. People had different – there were some people who did acupuncture, but that was more for, you know, like recovering from injury or if their muscles were spasming up or things like that, but not quite so much performance enhancement. But then what I learned from talking to some of the other people was how the energy of being in a baseball game affected them. One that was quite memorable is I – just had an opportunity to interview, you know, the star player of the team, David Ortiz. And he's a very personable guy and very funny and all. But he talked about fan energy and how he felt it in his heart. And, you know, the fans loved him. There's no two ways about it. And he could feel it. He could feel it in his heart center. And it helped him, you know, it gave him more juice. One of the other players described it, probably not as G-rated, but he said it was like fan energy is like amphetamine, that it gave him a boost of energy that he could use as reliably as amphetamine. And then another guy described how he was a pitcher and he knew ahead of time when he was in the zone what the batter was going to do and what the batter was looking for. And so he could take that into account and use it to his advantage. And he was actually not embarrassed to talk about parapsychology as a baseball player. And that goes back to Michael Murphy's book. So it was just very cool to hear people talk about these kind of things. So it's there. It's very pervasive, and it's something that can be cultivated. And that, as I was saying before, that's the big change now. One of my, as a result of doing that documentary, I began to do some presentations on the topic and met up with sports psychologists and energy practitioners. We formed a group that our focus was on sports, energy, and consciousness. And we did put together an edited book about it, but one of my collaborators, a tennis pro named Scott Ford, he had the saying, the zone by choice, not chance. And that really, that changes it to a matter of intention and focus rather than, you know, thanking your lucky stars. And that's really what colors a lot of the approaches. Now, he had a unique approach for tennis that it's actually a paradox, because he basically says, don't keep your eye on the ball, because when you're focusing on the ball, you're too busy analyzing. It's going this way and the angle is that way and you hit this way. It's going more to the peripheral big picture point of view, where your body will know what to do if all the information is coming through. He calls it parallel mode processing. And I actually tried it out, did a demo with him, and it was quite remarkable how it is just like flipping a switch. So there are some techniques that don't take, you know, years of practice. You don't have to go to an ashram for 20 years or anything like that. You can literally learn it in a matter of minutes. And so his book was one of the key influencers in that regard. So it's changed the whole face of sports. And, you know, there's still a lot of the old, honestly, professional sports can be very macho, and, you know, you got to be tougher and stronger and not beat up the other guy, but it's really, you know, this kind of mentality rather than enhancing whatever your innate gifts are to the maximum. So it's a sports is another forum for this whole cultural transformation that we're going through. And it's, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again, we're not there yet, but there's some, this is one of the many good signs of the progress that we're making.
Methods like meditation and EFT have real science and research behind them. It isn't that people are just having wishful thinking that they do well.
Right. I mean, wishful thinking is actually important. The whole placebo effect of positive expectations is important. And there's actually a lot of research on placebo effect and what role it plays in everything from taking your penicillin tablets to acupuncture. But for sports performance, yeah, there is research on all of the things. And it's simple enough to do. Like an early one was about guided imagery, which is basically they took a fairly easy to reproduce sports performance, a free throw shooting, which is a basketball. You stand a set distance and nobody's there. You just shoot on your own. How many out of 10 can you get? And people will practice for a few hours each day to build up their skill. But so one group they had doing that kind of practice, and the other group at the same baseline level mentally practiced. They mentally saw the image of themselves shooting, even though they didn't touch a basketball during that hour or half hour. I forget how long it was. And you could get as good, if not better, improvement through mental imagery than through the physical practice itself. So this was probably like 20 years ago it was done. So it's been known for a while. There's a whole area of research on sports performance. And, you know, it used to be more exercise physiology and how do you get more oxygen into your blood cells and have your mitochondria, blah, blah, blah. You know, that is an important piece of it. But once the psychological, emotional, and energetic piece came in, it really transformed it. So one very interesting application or area where sports performance overlaps with parapsychology came about as a result of an email I got once our group had formed and we put out a book, and you know, people find out about these things. So I got an email inquiry from a psychologist in Iraq, in Baghdad, who said he was very interested in the energetics of sports performance, and he used parapsychology in his work as the team parapsychologist for the Iraqi Olympic Committee, which was a job description I had never heard before. It's like, ah. So what he did was he had the clairvoyant gift that he could assess the energy status of an individual athlete or a team of athletes, and then take, you know, show them an exercise to enhance their energy flow. So, you know, I found that fascinating. And we actually did some distant studies where, you know, basically I would say the Red Sox are playing tomorrow. How do they look? And we kept a tally, and he had a very good track record of saying which team looked disorganized, they weren't in harmony, or individual players were out of whack. And I jokingly said to him once, well, you know, we should check out the Las Vegas betting line on some of these games and take advantage of your skills. And that was a real eye opener for me, because he had so much integrity that he said, you know, he was actually offended that I even made that joke, and rightfully so, because he was really interested in just the science of it and the performance of it. And it was a very American idea to try and make money off of it. So it was very humbling for me to have that come up. And but his ability is real. And I wouldn't be surprised if teams do something like that on the side. I haven't heard, you know, overt mention of it, but you know, that there's the description of his work. And he came to Boston once to lecture and speak to our folks here in town too. So there's some just fascinating ways that it can develop. And one other thing that I wrote about, because it really captivated me, was this is a couple of years ago. Well, I think it was 2020 during COVID, because outdoor sports, you know, group gatherings weren't allowed. Some sporting events took place, but without crowds. So it was very different vibe. So two things here. One is that what effect no crowds had on performance. But what I was going to say is that people went indoors and did their competitive stuff, and chess became really, really popular. Mm-hmm. And then there was this a mini series called The Queen's Gambit about it's based on a true story. It's fictional, but it's about a young girl who is a chess prodigy, and how she progresses through the ranks. And part of it is that I think it's pretty well known that chess players have excellent memories and can remember a game, you know, from well in the past. In this one, she saw visions on the ceiling of tomorrow's game, and how the moves were going to unfold. And, you know, it sounded, I mean, it was, I thought it was just very captivating. It's not that anybody actually does that. It's an example of what might be possible, because there's a lot of good parapsychological research on precognition that, and premonitions. And so this would be, this is just a, you know, sort of a Hollywood way of capturing it, but it was very, I was captivated by it. But anyway, so that's just another, another example of parapsychology and sports in the zone.
Yeah. Can we go back to EFT tapping and meditation? And can you share with us what is happening there that's helping people get into the zone and peak performances?
That's a very good question. And it depends what you mean by what is happening, because things happen on many different levels simultaneously. And I think what's limited Western medicine, if you want to get general about it, is that we focus so much on the physical. So the answer would be what is happening is your muscles relax and your heart rate slows down and your adrenaline levels go down. So it's all on the, you know, the physical, chemical, physiologic level. And those things do happen, and those things are really important. But then there's also the mind-body interaction. So there are things like there are ways to measure how your heart rate mirrors the degree of mind-body connection that you have. The heart is not a metronome, so the beats aren't as regular as that. The interval between the beats varies in certain patterns depending on your emotional state. And it's very easy to measure because, you know, you can get somebody's pulse just by a fingertip gauge or an earlobe gauge. And then there are different ways to measure what they call heart rate variability. So a group in California, the HeartMath Institute, has really refined this technique to measure what they call heart coherence, which is a state of special mind-body coordination that can be generated by the simple emotion of appreciation, that just by bringing yourself into feeling an appreciative state of mind, it changes your heart rhythms. So they have these trainings, and a lot of it is for personal health, for, you know, job performance and things like that. A couple of interesting applications have to do with what effect that has on other people. So one of the tests that we did in making the documentary film was at the HeartMath laboratory to see, because their model is that the when you're changing your heart rhythm, because the heart has so much electrical things happening, it generates a magnetic field. And this is easy to document, easy to measure, that extends out into space. So your heart, an energetic magnetic field, has to affect anybody near you because they're overlapping. It's just like that energy demonstration we did the last time with the hands. But just being near somebody, you can be in their energy space. So we wondered whether those heart vibes are somehow or other contagious. And so I was actually the guinea pig, and I was, you know, blindfolded and had my ears covered, sitting in the lab while they were measuring my heart rate variability with a monitor. And then, unbeknownst to me, four HeartMath practitioners came and sat down behind me and started to, you know, on signal, they started to go into this heart coherence mode to see what effect it would have on my baseline was, you know, kind of sputtering along. I didn't know how to do this meditation, so I was not able to generate coherence. Within like 10 seconds, it's really quick, my readings on the graph went not off the chart, but it was really a dramatic kind of impact.
Today, I'm going to be the guinea pig. We've got a demonstration set up at the HeartMath Institute to illustrate the ways that human energy fields can influence other people who are the focus of their attention. I'm going to be connected up to this computer that will measure my own heart rate and assess whether I independently can get into this rhythm of heart coherence. But at some point, I will be joined by a group of people who are skilled at entering this state, and we'll test whether there's a group field effect that begins to influence me once they enter the room by watching what happens to my recordings on the monitor. I'll be blind, though, because I'll be wearing these and covering my ears with these.
so that my own cognitive reaction and awareness of their presence won't be the key variable. So whatever change happens will be because my nervous system, out of my conscious awareness, responds to the coherent energy field that the group is able to create. And we're assuming that something similar happens in a baseball game when enough crowd people are in a state of appreciation and enjoyment that it begins to entrain the baseball players to enter into a coherent state that enhances their actual performance in the game itself.
Well, we've actually done some experiments showing that small groups of people can affect outcomes of other experimental processes. And it's really not a very big jump. We already know that human-to-human interaction is not only possible, occurs, whether we believe it or not, these things are going on, or like it or not, this really is occurring. So we're able to, in a very fairly straightforward way with in our lab, show that one person's heartbeat, and kind of that radio, that wave of energy is traveling out. We can now hook up another person and detect that that field is showing up in another person's brainwaves, their nervous system. So we can measure this energetic interaction between people in a very rigorous scientific way. And so we can see now that he's 100% incoherent.
How'd I do?
Earplugs, yeah.
How'd I do?
Experiment actually worked.
Really?
It really did. Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks, guys.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, this is the, I don't know if we have it all on film or not.
Better.
This is the whole section here where you were by yourself.
Okay.
And then they came in about right in here.
Okay.
And then
something happened.
And then I signaled them to shift into the coherent state and send you positive intention. And then we see the heat right after that. He indeed shifted into a, this is a very profound shift in terms of what's going on inside of his body. And this is what we call coherence. So this is really an optimal state. And now Rick's own energetic field, the magnetic field of the heart, is also much more coherent now when he's in this state. And we see that shift down here. We're tracking his coherence level. Here it went up and down some. Again, he was trying to be coherent. Here's where the group came into the room and waited a little bit, and then they shifted into coherence right in here. And then we see that dramatic increase in Rick's coherence. First step was showing that, yes, the signal is detected. It gets there. The more intriguing thing is we've been able to show that the information contained on those fields or modulated in those fields is different depending on the emotional state that we're in. And it has a direct mathematical correlation back to our heart's rhythmic patterns.
You definitely want to have positivity going on around you and the result of things that you go for is just going to be totally different, but the way you want.
Well, I guess the key question for me is, when I'm in this state, can I hit a curveball?
Because we've done experiments that show that when you're in a coherent state, your reaction times are quite a bit faster. Wow. It's about 37 milliseconds in fact, which is the equivalent of 10 miles an hour difference in a pitch. So in other words, if a pitcher threw a ball at 90 miles an hour and you were in a coherent state, you would perceive it like it was 80.
That's the difference that could make the difference. And fans can harness the power of their own positive emotions to create one huge energy field that entrains the players. Maybe someday we'll have pre-game heart coherence meditation for everyone.
The finding there is that these, whatever level of electromagnetic field you're generating, affects people in the vicinity, and it's like a resonance. It was exactly like tuning forks. Actually, that's the best comparison. They were vibrating at that particular, frequency, and my nervous system as tuning fork began to resonate in harmony with it. So it's very, very dramatic that way. But it also, the context was how it relates to things like team chemistry. And that if you have a team that's emotionally attuned with each other, they'll automatically start to bring each other into the state of higher and higher alignment. And when you're in a state of heart coherence, your coordination is better. Dr. McCready, who led the project, he said that the speed of your reflexes is increased by 0.1 milliseconds or something like that. That's equivalent in baseball. You begin to perceive a 90-mile-an-hour pitch as though it's only going 80 miles an hour. Things literally slow down because your reflexes are so accelerated when you're in this state of heart coherence. So a good team can get into coherence themselves. If one person is having an off day, the teammates can literally lift them up. So that was one of the really interesting findings from our research, because, we certainly saw it with the Red Sox, but you see it in many, many sports teams, and not just in sports. We do teamwork, in our 9-to-5 work, and there's a big influence in, human resources and job environment, organizational culture and things like that. And often they'll give lip service to these ideas, but there are actual practices that you can start a meeting with 2 minutes of mindfulness or 2 minutes of appreciation, and people operate on a whole different level. So, I think some of the original work was with sports, but it can be in a family setting. Families have their own rituals for, like, at the beginning of a meal, to even as simple as taking a deep breath together can really bring about energetic alignment. So there's a lot of ways in which these group energies are processes to really take advantage of. And, musicians talk about it when they work together with the people in their ensemble. They sort of feel like they're all on the same wavelength. That's a phrase that's very commonly used. And, many different activities have their slang words for being in the zone, but it's a common enough experience. So it was fun to be able to measure and do some of the research. You mentioned EFT. EFT, I think one of the really important strategic decisions they made as an organization 20 years ago was to make research a priority. This is the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, ACEP, ACEP. Their website, energypsych.org, has a whole, you can, press the link to research, and there's literally hundreds of studies now documenting in all different settings and to all different degrees of control and dismantling studies and whatnot, that these are real effects, and you can measure everything from the level of immunoglobulins in saliva as an example of how it enhances your immune system, to brain waves and EEGs and actually MRIs, the functional magnetic resonance imagery, is sort of the gold standard now for proving that something is real, to prove that something happens. To go back to your original question, this is sort of, up there on a pedestal. And recently, it's been hard to get these studies done because most of the EFT researchers don't have, big academic organizations behind them, but a psychologist in Australia, Peter Stapleton, has been able to pull together some MRIs to show that in things like post-traumatic stress disorder, that the different parts of the limbic system are quieted down and other parts of the regulatory system are activated. So it really fits the theoretical model perfectly. The findings of the function of different parts of the brain fits the model perfectly. So there's a lot of validation now that these things like EFT or meditation can have a profound effect on the brain and the nervous system. That's what the science is interested in. But I add the next level of on the energy as well. It's harder to measure the energy, but I think that's really the driving force, is you first affect the energy and then the brain kind of follows suit. It's going to be a while before we can prove that, but that's sort of my hunch about how it works.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into that coherent state?
During that demonstration?
Yeah.
Well, it was nothing I did. That was what was so weird. I could feel something happening. I didn't know how to do the HeartMath meditation then. So they just said, go just sit and relax and, chill. And, you know, I tried my best to be relaxing, but I didn't know that particular one. And so that's why my mom, it's actually pretty funny in the video, because you can see my recording is pretty bumpy at the bottom level. And Roland, the director, said, you know, at this point, when we looked at it after, he says, at this point, you're pretty incoherent. And I took that as a personal insult, but no, that's just the terminology. When they started to meditate, that's when my nervous system shifted into this other mode. And it wasn't anything I did. I could just feel something shift. And it's this energy sensation that you, if you have experienced it, you get to know. And it's very pleasant. And you can't really say where it comes from, but it was very tangible. So, you know, I just kind of went into this. And for whatever reason, so I thought it was a very important demonstration that this stuff, you know, we don't end at our skin and we impact everybody. And, you know, personal relationships are all about compatible energies. And what do you do if somebody's energy doesn't vibe with you and things like that? And so now, you know, we're getting to the science behind it all.
People can get into a coherent state with certain practices. And in that demonstration, you were showing how other people's coherent states can impact another person.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are, it's not a new finding. And for example, I had mentioned musicians that a lot of performers will talk about the importance of the audience and having that connection with the audience so that they can feed off the audience's energy. And, you know, I'm sure everybody who's watching this has been to some sort of performance or show where it was really tangible, but whether it was your favorite musician or somebody new who everybody was just discovering, something happens that's in the air. And, I think it is fundamentally electromagnetic, and that's what communicates. Musicians love this. I'm blanking now on who it was that I quote in the book, but during COVID, they weren't doing any live performances and some studio work, but without the interaction. And she said how it feels like she's sort of starving, that she really needs that.
Tori Amos.
Yes. And that's a common thing. You know, the flip side or the dark side of that is that performers can get addicted to that energy, and they thrive when they're on stage, and then after they leave, things just fall apart because they don't have other ways of generating their own energy. And that's where I think that's a big part of why substance abuse is such a problem in the performing arts and, you know, the Hollywood scene and all. I think that's part of it. And that there's an energetic aspect to the whole thing. So, yeah, I mean, it's not for everybody. Many people have a fear of, say, public speaking. And I remember reading that's the most common fear. I don't know if it was in America or where the study was done, but people were more afraid of public speaking than of dying, if you can imagine that. So some people do not know how to take in that energy and actually push it away because they have their judgments about it. But once you can get past that and see it as something positive, you can really feed off it. And in sports, it shows up with the difference between being cheered by the home team, by the home team crowd, or being booed when you're in the other side's home stadium. And so that's a skill that players have learned how to deal with boos, with being, getting that kind of negative. And some of the players described how they took it as a compliment that the opposing fans would boo them, because that's a recognition that they're good and that the opposing fans are doing all they can to bring down the performance. So they used a mental trick to turn what could be a negative energy into a positive, because it's just, you know, it's just sound. It's just vibration. Whatever meaning there is what you give to it. So they found a way to give a positive meaning to what would seem to be a negative experience, and it worked. So, I mean, that was a whole other interesting part of it, was the fan energy, not just the team chemistry, but the fan energy and what that can do. Because, you know, as we're talking about with musical performances, the bigger the performance, the bigger the energy, to the point where you can affect an entire generation with a musical performance. And I have some quotes in the book about Woodstock that was, I've forgotten the numbers now, it was 200, 300,000 people. You know, it's not the largest performance ever, but it had such a strong meaning that an entire generation sort of has been and was and has been inspired by it. So there's something really important about these large group energies too. And the athletes, you know, they obviously enjoy performing in front of their home crowd. It was interesting during COVID, like I mentioned, a lot of events happened for a year or so in sports leagues where they perform in front of empty stadiums or stadiums where they had, it's kind of, there's some funny photographs out there of cardboard cutout figures of audience members and, you know, they're running races. And I would have thought it would be very off-putting, but what they found was the so-called home field advantage dissipated. Usually there's statistical significance. You can find a definite level of advantage when your team plays in front of their home crowd compared to when they're on the road playing against, you know, in another team's stadium. And during that COVID year, that advantage was gone because it was just in one empty stadium or another. There was no cheering, there was no booing, there was no support, anything like that. And there were some studies in Germany in their soccer league, their football league, that it was like a 10% decrease in American football. It was even more, I think it was usually the home team would win about 60% of the games. And during that season, it was like 49%. So, you know, basically it became 50-50. It wasn't an advantage. So there is something to that large scale group energy as well. And that's something that we tried to measure it using, it's a computer technique that was developed by Princeton University that basically sounds like science fiction. But what they found, and they've studied this for over 40 years, so it's not some new thing that they just come up with, is that human thought can affect physical events that are happening in the laboratory. And the one that they have gotten the most mileage out of, I guess you could say, is it's the equivalent of flipping a coin for heads and tails. You know, if you do it a lot, you get, you know, 50-50 or 51-49, you know, kind of pretty close to random all the time. So they were seeing what effect thinking had on, not coin flip, but they had a way of a computer generating ones and zeros in a random sequence, what they called a random number generator. So it's like flipping a coin 1,000 times a second. So you get very long streams of data and see what happens if somebody sits in front of the computer and kind of meditates at the computer, if you will. And lo and behold, there would be statistically significant shifts in whichever direction the person or the group of people was intending by their power of thought. So that alone shouldn't happen because there's nothing connecting, you know, there's no wires between my brain and the computer. So how it happens is a whole other question. And that gets it in the realm of quantum entanglement and things like that, that I will admit that I don't really have a clue about. but the fact that you could measure it was important. So we did something similar to what the Princeton people and the noetic science people have. You can put the software on a computer and just take your laptop wherever and measure what's going on. So we did one at a baseball game. And it was fun, but it was also, I have to say, it was pretty cleverly set up because the idea was that I was watching the game and I would just make a note of a time when I thought the crowd was really focused on something. And it could be because somebody got a big hit or didn't get a hit or whatever. And I just jotted down like the 5 or 10 moments that I thought were the key. And I would write down, you know, at 2:47, David Ortiz hit a home run in the crowd. And, you know, just my list. The computer was actually in another part of the stadium, not next to me, generating its sequence. After the game was over, I sent the data file to be analyzed. And he came back with a graph that showed sort of the fluctuations from baseline. And in the game, there were several moments where it rose above what they call statistical significance that couldn't be just from random fluctuations. Something else was happening to influence it. And the question was, were those moments of statistical significance on the computer at all related to my moments where I thought something was happening? And it was like 5 out of the 7 were the ones that I had identified ahead of time. So out of the 3 hours of the game, I picked the 5 30-second intervals that the computer also registered. And I honestly couldn't believe it, actually, when we saw the data, because it was such a good correlation. But it's actually not new, that the idea that these computers can respond to large-scale events has been documented by the Princeton people, by an offshoot called the Global Consciousness Project, and now they've actually blended in with the HeartMath people in what they are now calling the Global Coherence Initiative. And those are phrases that you can Google. They each have websites, and there's a lot of data. It's not just wild speculation. That's what's really impressive, is that there's a lot of data now, and all pointing in the same direction. That the Global Consciousness Project, for example, has a network of, I think it's like 50 or 60 computers around the world continuously sending out these random number chains just to see what happens, what kind of fluctuations there are. And it turns out that in certain epochal, big events, the worldwide network will register, even though they're miles and miles away from whatever is happening. So there's some really extraordinary things out there. One really good example is a group of sound healers from Colorado, Jonathan and Andy Goldman, have an annual World Sound Healing Day, which they invite people to find a way to make sounds that carry their intent for world healing. And it could be humming or chanting or singing or whatever. And what they've noted is, how does this network of computers respond on that day? And there's one, it's not in the book, but on the book's website, themysteryoflifeenergy.com, under the highlights, there's a picture of the graph from that particular day. And it's far above the level of randomness only for that day. And, that's the only thing that was happening that could influence it. So it's really extraordinary how large groups can be held together by some sort of energetic coherence in a way that many people have experienced it subjectively, but now we're having some devices that can measure it objectively as well. So that's the really nice balance that I think for many people, it starts with a inner experience, but then to get validated by a machine is nice as well.
What is happening when people are getting into the zone or a state of peak performance or experience on a physiological level, or as you've mentioned several times, on an energetic level?
A lot is happening, and it can be everything from like EEG brainwaves, going into a more deeper rhythm. It can be the heart rhythm, the hormones that are released, the this one just came up, the runner's high that you may have heard about, that when runners get into their zone, it's a high feeling that they initially was thought to be due to endorphins, that natural endorphin release when you're in this state. But somebody thought to test it by using an endorphin blocker, naloxone, and people still had the runner's high, even though their endorphins were being blocked. So a little bit more research, and they found out it was actually from the endocannabinoids that the body was producing its own innate form of marijuana, basically. And the high was like a cannabis high. And so the, you know, the same kind of testing with blocking agents and measuring levels and things like that. But just to show that there's a physical, physiologic, biochemical, neurotransmitteral correlation to what we feel subjectively. And it's just, you know, fascinating to see that those things are there and are reproducible and measurable. We actually don't have such good methods of measuring energetics yet. You know, sort of like the dilemma we talked about last time with phantom limbs and not having a reliable way to take a photograph, an image of the phantom of the biofield. Same way, there are devices like the BioWell that Beverly Rubik has worked with that is an important first step in that direction. But honestly, we're not there yet. But it's happening on all levels. And this is a little bit of a digression, but it shows how, in some ways, how primitive our Western focus is on flesh and blood. There's a phenomenon in Tibetan Buddhism of deep meditation during the dying process, to the point where some masters have died, but their body stays alive looking for days. It doesn't decompose the way, it doesn't even slump over the way bodies normally do. So some Western scientists were studying that. It's called Tukdam, T-U-K-D-A-M. And they were studying it. And the way they chose to study it was to, they had found out about somebody who had just entered this state, and they were measuring like heartbeat and temperature and things like that, as though that's going to tell them the secret to this obviously very profound, deep state that has nothing. I watched the documentary, and even though the lead researcher is one of the leading meditation researchers in America, it just struck me as so primitive. And one of the Tibetan doctors who was consulting said, you know, you should be looking into the wind. That was their word for the energy. You should be looking into the wind and how that changes when Rinpoche goes into this altered state. But it just, because we don't have the measurement devices, it doesn't exist. And we're very, you know, tunnel visioned on that. So it's changing. I think, you know, 5 years from now, for sure, we'll be able to have much more of a way to measure these things. But ultimately, how important is it to be able to measure these different altered states? I think it's helpful to deal with skeptics to show them here's some data. But I really don't think it changes people's minds so much as having a personal experience of it, or knowing somebody that they trust who's had a personal experience of it. And that's what triggers it. But you know, it's good to do. It's good to have. I mean, I can't dismiss it. I spent my whole career doing it, so I do think there's a lot of value to it. But there's more to it than just that. That's what I'm trying to say.
The HeartMath Institute has also been studying the heart and the electromagnetic field of the heart in pretty detailed manner, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really important contribution that they've made, is by focusing on the heart. The heart actually has the strongest magnetic field of any part of the body, more than the brain even, which surprised me to learn about. I don't have it handy. But their website and books have a diagram that's showing that the lines of force coming from the heart, just like they do from a magnet. There are electrophysiologic reasons why that would happen, but there's also spiritual energetic reasons too, because the heart is a really key energy center or chakra, and in some systems it's the most important one. It's where the spiritual energies are anchored in the body. It's sort of the balancing point between the physical and this metaphysical. So, and I think, you know, they've done a really good job of measuring all the aspects of the physiology of the heart and how that changes. And they have developed several techniques. The heart coherence is just one, but it's probably their best known one.
How much of a role do you think appreciation or love plays in peak experiences?
In interpersonal, outside of the sports arena, for sure it does. And you can sort of kind of understand that. And, you know, whether it's just falling in love and that sense of appreciation, that kind of peak experience or altered state of consciousness, and interpersonal things, but also in sports, it's a funny kind of thing that, you know, we tend to think of our view of sports tends to be us versus them and good guys and bad guys and grind them down and beat them up and things like that. It's very negative and very survival oriented. That's the way to put it. So love doesn't seem to have a role to play, but some of the people that, that I worked with through this sports energy group, have had a different focus on it. Again, I can't remember who first pointed it out. The word competition, it's a Latin word, and the origin of it is to strive together. Mm. It's not head to head. It's calm, you know, cooperating. And patere means to strive. So it's a joint effort to achieve excellence. That's how I've come to think of competition now. And you do that when you're in a state of appreciation that the team or the opponent that you're playing against is working on the same process with you, that you're actually in it together. And when you can appreciate that, that helps performance as well. There's a group of Canadian, I think they were both rowers, competitive rowers, Robin Megger and Jason Dorlan, who have the title of one of their articles is Love as a Competitive Strategy. And that's, again, it's one of those phrases that sounds like nonsense, but I think it's more like a koan, you know, one of those really deep, deep meaning sayings that's worth pondering. And you can Google it. It's just by that phrase, and to show that appreciation can be brought into settings that one would never imagine.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the main ways to achieve a coherent state is appreciation. And also, I like what you're saying about how with the competition, it seems that each side you're suggesting then is bringing out the best in each other.
Yeah. And that's a, you know, it's not the most common attitude we have in America these days to competitive sports, but it's there too. And I think it's a deeper level, and, you know, it's easy for me to say, cause I'm not caught up in that world of wanting to win a gold medal or what have you, but it's there too. And that's why this group that we started originally, we were focused on sports, energy, and consciousness. It's now called the EVO Evolutionary Sports Collective, EVO Sports. And that's a website that you can also, and it features, you know, monthly seminars with different coaches on different ways of getting into the zone or working on team coherence or, you know, this sense of competition in the positive sense of the word. So that's another important resource that's out there for viewers to check out.
Yeah. What is your favorite way to get into the zone?
Well, that's interesting. I have different ways depending on time and place and all that. This time of year, for example, this spring, I'm in New England, and it wasn't a harsh winter by any means, but it was a longer one. And it's just now the weather is getting warm enough and sunny enough to go out into the garden and start. I like to grow vegetables and fruits and berries and things like that. So, you know, there's a saying that you want to feel, it's an important meditation goal to feel grounded. Well, the way I feel grounded is to, you know, have the ground in my hand and, you know, really dig and scrape and push some seeds in. And, you know, you can do it with a sense of the energetics of it too, and working with the nature sprites or spirits or forces or however, the ley lines. That's a whole other area about the energies of the earth that I am more and more taken by, and maybe we could talk about that at some other time, but the way the earth has her own energies that are very analogous to the human acupuncture meridians. There's tradition originating from Britain called ley lines and there's some really fascinating evidence that these are energy alignments as well, where some of the stone circles like Stonehenge and Avebury have been constructed. So I like to work with that. And it's just this early season, the trees are just leafing out, and there's many, many shades of green to the leaves that, you know, eventually in another couple of weeks, they'll all be that deep green, chlorophyll green. But right now there's a lot of different shades of green. And I kind of joke to friends that, you know, New England is known for the fall foliage season, but I think we should have a spring foliage season too, because there's a whole different kind of beauty as nature sort of waking up. And, you know, whatever the subtle energies are that get activated by spring and sunlight. In my blog, if people want to go to the website and you can check the blog, I've written a couple about the recent solar eclipse that was, we went, it's only a couple of hours away, we went to visit, and what are the energetics of that, and what sort of subtle energy does sunlight convey, and why is, you know, winter blahs and spring fever and things like that. So there's a subtle energy to that as well. And so I think the energies of nature is my current favorite way of getting into the zone.
I understand. I love gardening, and nature has an amazing force to it, although we think of it as separate, but we're part of it. Earthing has real science behind it as well, as to how it can impact a person, their health, their physical and mental health.
Yeah. So, I mean, I talked about grounding in a very literal sense of, you know, working with the earth, with the dirt itself. But there's also a notion that something electrical happens, electromagnetic happens when you're in direct contact with the earth. And that led to, I should check the dates, probably about 10 years ago, a book called Earthing, which summarized a lot of research that's been done to show that there are health benefits to making physical contact with the earth itself. And that's not like going for a walk if you're wearing shoes. It's because the idea is that the shoes, you know, whatever rubber soles or whatever, insulate you and disconnect you from the earth itself. When your physical body touches the earth's physical body, then the electrical flow can rebalance whenever there's, you know, a storage of excess electrons, it can be rebalanced. So, and it's why, you know, it feels nice to walk outside in the grass barefooted or in the beach or wherever. So it started out just from that observation, but then recognizing that you can't always go outside barefoot, like if in winter or if you're in the city or what have you. So a couple of researchers, cardiologist Steven Sinatra and Gaetan Chevalier, was an electrical engineering type of person. They developed very, very simple devices to allow you to ground. You lie on a mat that's connected to your house wiring that is grounded. Every house has to be grounded in case of electrical, you know, lightning problem. So you can actually ground from inside a building by lying on the special mat or putting your feet on the special mat. And you know, it's an intervention. They've done clinical studies on everything from anxiety level, subjective reports of anxiety levels and sleep problems to measuring what effect does it have on blood chemistry. And to their credit, they've documented some very significant things, especially the role of inflammation. Low level inflammation is a really common factor in a lot of our chronic illnesses. And so this can act as an anti-inflammatory and prevent or reverse a lot of really significant medical illnesses that we are burdened by. And, you know, there's a lot of lifestyle factors too, with poor diet and lack of exercise. But this kind of earthing is a natural antioxidant. So that's a really important one. And, you know, that ties into some of the other themes that I'll be glad to come back and talk about regarding the earth and the earth's energies and what happens at certain points in the earth's energy system when unusual things will happen.
Dr. Rick Leskowitz, thank you so much for all that you shared with us today and helping us to harness, cultivate peak experiences and getting in the zone. I'm looking forward to definitely having you back. I know you have a trip coming up where you're going to be exploring more features that can occur on the earth, and we'll have a nice conversation when you get back from your amazing trip.
Thank you, Emmy. I'm looking forward to the trip, but I'm looking forward to also talking to you about it, because we're going to explore not just the Stonehenge Avery places, but also some of the unusual phenomena that happen in those regions known as crop circles. So I'll leave that as the teaser for until next time.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being with me today, Rick. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, you're very welcome. And I will thank you as well, because it has been, once again, enjoyable to chat.
And I look forward to our next conversation. And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.